Okay, good morning, everybody. Welcome to CSIS. My name is Armand Pechard-Sverdra. I'm the director of the Mexico Project here at CSIS. And it's a real honor for us to be hosting a good friend, Luis Carlos Ugalde, the president of Mexico's Federal Electoral Institute. We've hosted him, I think, in May of this year, and he looked a lot younger. So I don't know, Luis Carlos, have you been under any pressure lately? But it's great to have Luis Carlos here with us today to talk about Mexico's presidential and federal congressional elections. And I want to apologize because we have a problem with, we've got the heat on in the entire building, and they're trying to figure out whether there's a way to control it. So feel free to take your jackets off, because I'm afraid that I think it'll probably get warmer rather than cooler as the event progresses. Having said that, I think Luis Carlos, I don't know if I should introduce you any further. Everybody has their bios. Luis Carlos, as you all know, was elected president of the General Council of the IFE. Prior to that, he had served in government and in various capacities at the Energy Ministry, at Banobras, obviously here at the embassy as chief of staff to the ambassador, and also he also has a distinguished academic career. So he's no stranger to Washington, and we're delighted that he's here with us this morning. And Luis Carlos, I'll give you the floor.
Thank you very much. Armand says I look younger in May, and probably I look younger today than 2 months ago, so it is better than saying that way. I will try to share with you some experiences and some reflections on the Mexican election, and it will take time to have a balanced reading and a balanced analysis of what happened in Mexico, because what happened in Mexico not only relates to election day, it relates to the whole political process surrounding the Mexican election. And I think for the future we need to make that review, that analysis. And today let me share some preliminary conclusions and lessons learned from our Mexican election. I will briefly describe each one of them, and the first one, and I will go later into detail, is that you can always count on citizens to organize clean elections. The second one is that technical competence and expertise are key for election management. Third one is that political context can create the perfect storm. I think our election, in many ways, was the perfect storm. And when that happens, the electoral authority sometimes is very limited to act as a political referee. The fourth, and very important, I would say, this is the most important structural difference of these elections vis-a-vis other elections, is that margin does matter, and matters a lot. The fifth is that leveling the playing field is crucial for electoral competitiveness, and not only for that, for the perception of a fair election. It is very important that participants perceive that the conditions for campaigns are fair and equal for all participants. The sixth is at the left, and this is not good, this is something very relevant for the political future of Mexico. The left show its best electoral performance ever, and I would say there is no other election in Mexico in which one party and one political force has increased its political position in Mexican politics as much as the left in this election. The seventh is that fraud allegations can have an impact despite the absence of evidence. The eighth is that solving new problems with old rules, and probably this is the second most relevant lesson from this election, is that if you have new problems but the same law, you are in trouble as an electoral authority to deal with an election process. The ninth is that for the future, don't change what worked well. And there are many things in the Mexican election that perform pretty well, despite allegations on the contrary, and fix what didn't. And this has to take us into the future, because I would say that this election should be an opportunity to make the reforms needed and to keep what worked well. And now let me go into the explanation of each one of these nine lessons, let me label it that way, from this experience. The first one, and we shouldn't forget that, is that citizen participation was very good. Civic duty was at its peak in Mexican recent history. Almost 1 million randomly selected citizens were ready to receive and count the votes. And I would say this is the strongest axis of the Mexican citizens. It is up to citizens who run the election and who count the votes, despite errors made on election date. I will talk about that later. Second, there were about 103,000 polling places operated by these citizens. There were about 2,000 non-partisan citizens who oversaw the process as members of electoral councils throughout Mexico. And there were electoral observers from within Mexico and from the international scene. This thing, I would say, is the strongest element of the Mexican system, that the election is run by citizens, with IFE acting as the trainer, IFE acting as the coordinator, but it is citizens who act as electoral authorities throughout these 130,000 polling places throughout Mexico. And I would say this is the first thing we should repeat and repeat and repeat. And about 42 million people voted on that election day. The second thing is, I would say that the IFE show again that it has experience and highest standards of competence. All goals were achieved. We had the highest figure installing polling stations. Only 11 out of 130,477 polling stations were not installed on election day. So this is the best figure ever in IFE's short history. We produced millions and millions of documents with anti-counterfeit technology to prevent fraud. We had the largest number of voters with ID cards, 71.3 million. And we had other things and materials like the special link to prevent duplicate voting. So logistically speaking, IFE performed very well with the same standards of past elections, and I would say in many respects with better numbers than in the past. Electoral results systems work safely and adequately. I will talk about this because these systems have been subject to a lot of controversy, but the quick count made by IFE, the preliminary electoral results program known as PREP, and the district level tally sheet count all were very coincident. All of them have similar numbers at the end. Let me show you, for example, here you have the numbers for each one of these results programs. If you see, the first one is the quick count made by IFE on election night, and you will see that beginning on July the 2nd, IFE had these numbers, which we knew 2 months later were going to be the final results. You can see here that in the PREP, when you include all the numbers, the so-called inconsistency ballots, you will have that the PREP here falls within the numbers of the quick count. The 35.9%, the 35.29%, all fall within the ranges of the quick count. It means that despite the fact that IFE was not able to disclose the results of the quick count, and we were not able to disclose those results basically for two reasons. First, statistically speaking, it was too close to call. And second, there was an agreement with political parties. This is very important to say. It was not discretionary to me. It was a decision taken by a technical committee of 5 members who decided that it was too close to call. And second, there was an agreement with political parties that in case that the results fell within the margin of error, the committee would decide not to give these results. And that is what IFE or myself did on election night. Say, it is too close to call, we cannot say who the winner was because they are very close, each one of them. However, if you realize, you will see that in each one of these three methods of the quick count, the PAN candidate was marginally above the other candidate. Imagine what would have happened if I come, as many have suggested. The president of IFE comes out and say, well, they are tied, statistically speaking, but let me tell you that the PAN candidate is marginally above the coalition candidate. All those that have suggested that I would have come out and said what the margins were, probably if I had done that, in case Paris and IFE had agreed to do so, probably the problem would have been bigger than what it was on that week. So we have to be very clear about what the rules were and how we abided by those rules to let people know what was able to be known on election night. But the most important is, in a very close election, sometimes it's an anticlimax to come out and say, well, we cannot give results because they are tied, statistically speaking. If you see, well, let me, podemos quitar esta silla. If you see here the tally sheet count, which is made district by district and which was made the following Wednesday, if you see the results of the tally sheet count, which is made in person with representatives of all political parties, this is very much in consonance with the prep and very much in consonance with the quick count. And when you see the final results given by the Electoral Tribunal, you will see that the difference between the prep, between the first and second place, which was, according to prep, 0.62, is very similar to the district-by-district count, which was made by IFE the following Wednesday, and very close to the court final count. This is the time in which electoral results provided by IFE has been so coincident all about them. In 2000, for example, let me give you an example, the difference between the prep and the tally sheet district-by-district count, the difference was about 0.31%. This time the difference is 0.04%, which means that the prep today was 8 times more precise than in 2000. Let me tell you, however, that when you have this close race, this razor-thin margin, people do not pay attention to how precise your electoral monitoring was. People just pay attention to the fact that the electoral authority was unable to provide results, and therefore, let me share with you that according to Parametria, which is a polling firm in Mexico, 45% of Mexicans consider that the DIFE did a mistake by not providing official results on election night. It doesn't matter that IFE said once and again that if these close elections were to be like this, the quick count technical committee would recommend to the IFES president that it was impossible to provide results and therefore that we had to wait until the tally sheet district by district count were going to occur on the following Wednesday. No matter we did that, if you come out on election night in Mexico and in any other country in the world, you will create some misperceptions that the electoral authority didn't work well because it didn't give results. So this is one of the most important elements to have in mind to understand why in the coming weeks many Mexicans were ready to believe many allegations of electoral fraud because they thought that the electoral authority was not transparent in explaining what happened. If we had been very transparent and had provided these results on election night, probably problems would have been unstoppable and in very difficult terms than how they evolved in the following days. Let me provide you with more information. These are the exit polls and quick counts made by private firms. They were not published that day because they were too close to call. But here you will say that in the same vein as IFE did the quick count, the IFE's quick count, all these exit polls and quick counts made by private firms are more or less in accordance to IFE's results that day and the following day. If you see, with the exception of Covarrubias Asociados, who provided the candidate of the coalition with a higher figure, in the rest, either they are tied or the PAN candidate comes first. So private firms' results that day are also in accordance with what was at the end the final and official result of the election. We will make this presentation available to CSIS and to all of us that provide us with your email, so if you want to have this information. And let me tell you that on IFE's webpage, you have a lot of information, this information and more information about voting, about laws, about procedures along the electoral process. If you want to consult that information on the IFE's webpage, you have a lot of information, more than ever, about what happens on the election process. Now, let me talk about the political context. In some way, we have a deeply ingrained culture of mistrust in politics and political institutions. This is nothing new. In many ways, IFE and the tribunal are institutions with a lot of confidence and credibility and trust, even today after the political conflict after July the 2nd. But it has been very difficult in Mexico to change that perception of Mexicans regarding their institutions, their politicians, and this is something that we need to take into account. It goes many decades and many centuries back, and therefore this is an element in the psyche of Mexicans that we need to have in mind. Second, when the presidential campaigns began in January of this year, there was a context of previous political conflict which had been in the making for many years, particularly between President Fox and Andrés Manuel López Obrador. And therefore, this is something that we need to keep in mind. As in contrast to other electoral processes, I would say that the context of previous conflict made a difference at the beginning of presidential campaigns. Have in mind that the process of impeachment against the then governor of Mexico City was perceived as a political attack. Had this impeachment process not occurred in Mexico in 2004 and 2005, probably the perception of the July and the second election would have been different. If you have a process which captured the attention of Mexicans for so many months, almost a year, about this impeachment which was perceived as a political attack, then the likelihood of these Mexicans that perceive this as a political attack may come to see the post-electoral conflict as a continuation of these conflicts among elite members in Mexico. Then it was the president of the Republic. Was he a political referee or part of the conflict or part of the game? Many in Mexico believe, and I do, that the president of Mexico should act not only as president, meaning his or her civic and legal duties, but also as a political referee. And being a political referee means abstaining from being a part of the problem or part of the campaigns. And I think these questions remain open. Should the president of Mexico, abiding by the rules and by the law be part or be involved in political campaigns as happens in the U.S., or should the Mexican case be different from other democracies in the world? This, I would say, is one of the most important elements to analyze for the future. What kind of democracy do we want? What type of role do we want the president of Mexico, and for that matter, state governors and other government officials to play during campaigns? We need to answer this because the Mexican law do not make specifics about this issue, and that explains part of the conflict that we saw in election, and I will discuss that later. And this very important, political actors unwilling to abide by the outcome. There is a saying in political science that democracies get consolidated when losers abide by the outcomes, not when winners win by wide margins, as happened in Mexico in 2000. In an election decided by 6 percentage points as in 2000, and when the government and the president of the republic come out and say, well, we abide, well, that is somehow easy. When you have a margin of this nature, of this small margin, it is very difficult, especially for an opposition candidate with so great expectations to win, to come out and abide by the rules, abide by the outcome, and I would say this is very relevant for the future. The fourth is margin does matter. You can see how elections were decided in the previous since 1994. 1994 was the first election organized, the first presidential election organized by IFE, and that there you have that with that margin, things come easy. Then in 2000 the margin was still very wide, but see how this is closed. A recent study by Lawrence Whitehead from Oxford shows that in any single country from 2000 to 2006 in which the margins have been small enough, a conflict has arisen, not only in emerging democracies but also in mature democracies. He takes a study analyzing the 2004 election in Taiwan, the election in Costa Rica, the election in the U.S. in which the Supreme Court play a key role in making actors comply with the ruling of the Supreme Court, the case of elections in Peru, many cases, and in any single case in which the margin is very small, conflict arises. The magnitude of the conflict depends on electoral institutions, on the political culture of the people, and other factors. But the fact of the matter is that margin does matter and explains. Let's imagine what would have happened in 2000 if you had the PRI candidate winning by 0.56%. Imagine what would have happened. If you remind, then candidate Vicente Fox had said, openly said, what was not said by any candidate this election. He said, if I lose by less than 10 percentage points, that means that there is fraud, and I will not recognize the outcome. He said that in Washington. He said that all across Mexico in the weeks prior to election day. So if he had lost by this margin, what would have happened? Or contrary, if the opposition candidate this time had won by this margin, or had won by this margin, if these candidates were in reversal order, what would have been the public perception about the election? Sometimes there is a saying among international electoral authorities in which you say, for an electoral authority, the best is that the opposition wins by a wide margin. When that happens, the electoral authority comes easily and very best regarded by public opinion. When the parrying government wins, and by a very small margin, sometimes things do not work easily among the perception of the people. This is how some conditions during campaign happened. According to political parties, and this is the information provided by the political parties, during the campaigns. These are early and preliminary reports made public by political parties to IFE. This will be reviewed, and political parties have submitted final reports on campaign spending, but so this is preliminary. The three main parties for the presidential campaign on media spent in these margins, which you can say that the differences are smaller than in previous presidential elections. So this is how much they spent according to their reports made public in the weeks before election day. I must say that we now in ATIFE are in the process of auditing campaign expenditures with different numbers, because at the end of the campaigns, parties came out, made final numbers, adjustments, and we'll review if this is true. But the playing field is better than in the past. As well, this is very important, for the first time ever, IFE decided to monitor TV ads by presidential candidates in seconds. So we will have this monitors TV ads on national television, regional television, prime time, and regular time. We review about more than 2 million hours, recorded more than 2 million hours in more than 35 cities across Mexico, and these are the final numbers. The number of seconds in which the presidential candidate of FAN was announced on TV was 275,000 seconds, the coalition candidate 319,000, and this is the number for the PRI. This combines prime time, regular time, national television, and regional television. And we also made a monitoring of this number of seconds of news coverage, and these are the numbers. As you can see, in contrast to the past, there are equal conditions for advertising, that is to say how much they paid for announcing, and how much news coverage they received. If you go on into the IFE's webpage, you can see these numbers section by section in a close analysis, because this is very aggregate and probably say little about what is the meaning of this. But I invite you to go into our webpage to analyze what is the meaning of very long studies. But this shows you that candidates in general had access to resources to make campaign. The sixth lesson, I would say, is that the left show its best performance ever. You have the numbers there. The increased rate of the left is the best of any other political force in Mexico. The growth is impressive this time, and I think we shouldn't forget that for political analysis in Mexico. Now let me talk briefly about allegations of electoral fraud, and there are some arguments that we need to discuss. The first was the PREP, and let me give you some arguments. The first is that PREP was secure, had state-of-the-art measures, and was overseen by an independent technical committee of five renowned scientists, most of them from the National University of Mexico, UNAM. Second, there was an allegation that for all of the PREP, for 24 hours, the PAN candidate was always at the top, and therefore, in a very close election, you had to have crossings between the two leading candidates, which didn't happen, beginning at 8 p.m. on election day. And yes, that is true. It didn't happen. It happened from 6:35 p.m. to 7:45, but after that, never happened again. Why? Because there is an urban bias of the PREP. Many people said that the PREP was a random exercise, and it is not true. That has a bias, an urban bias, because the tally sheets received first are those that come from urban areas, and in those places, as we will see later, the candidate from the PAN had a lead bigger than what it had on average at the national level, and that explains why, with our neural variance of the PREP, you had one candidate always above the second one. The second thing we need to talk about the PREP is that there is a second check, a safeguard. All parties have on election day a copy of the tally sheet of each polling place throughout Mexico, and therefore they can check that tally sheet with the results published in the PREP in internet. And that is, I think, something very important to say. This is how PREP behaved on election day. PREP begins to be published by this time, 8 p.m. Before 8 p.m., PREP was not public, and there were some crossings between the three candidates. You can see that the candidate of the PREP began at the top with the first few polling places reported, but then it stabilized, and the candidate of the PAN was above for the rest of the exercise. So this is explained according to many academic studies. This is explained because in the first hours of PREP, you began receiving tally sheets from urban areas in which the candidate of the PAN had a lead over this. When you had non-urban areas and rural areas tally sheets coming in, the margin, the difference closes and closes. Here you have the urban and non-urban vote, how it behaved. In the urban vote, you have that the difference, the candidate of the PAN obtained 11.7 million votes and the candidate of the PRD 11.06. Whereas in non-urban vote, the candidate of the coalition has a lead. And this difference, since 70% of the vote in Mexico, 70% of polling places are in urban areas and only 30% in non-urban areas, that explains what happened with PREP. Let me tell you something which has been claimed and is not true. Many people are saying that the Mexican election on July the 2nd has a divide between the urban and the rural, the north and the south, the rich and the poor. If you see here, and if you see by income distribution, you will see that both candidates were very competitive in urban areas and were very competitive in rural areas. So this idea that the Mexican election is a divide of the Mexican population is untrue. It's not true, neither north-south, nor urban or non-urban, nor rich and poor. And that claim that many people take as granted, we need to take a close look, because both candidates were very competitive in the north, in the south, in the rich, in the poor, in the rural, non-rural areas, and I think we need to take that into account. Another allegation, and I think probably this is the most important, is that there were thousands of numerical mistakes or math mistakes in the tally sheets. And let me tell you first that there are less mistakes than in 2000. According to a study made by CIDE, which is a research institution, very respected research institution in Mexico, in 2000 you have 51.4% of tally sheets with filling out mistakes, while in 2006 we still have a very large number, but smaller than in 2000. So despite the fact that in this election we had less mistakes than in 2000, this is the first time ever that those mistakes come out as an issue. And not only as an issue, but as an argument that these mistakes were the proof that there had been some sort of electoral fraud on election day. What are the type of mistakes we are talking about? The tally sheets have those two sections, the reference field in which you, in the morning, for example, one of the poll workers need to count how many ballots you received. Commonly you receive, let's say, 639 ballots. And then one of the poll workers need to count by hand or biometric and a math operation, how many ballots they receive. It has been shown and proved that on many occasions when you count 693 ballots, probably you make a mistake of one. Or sometimes you have 10 ballots, and the initial number of the ballot says 1, and the final one, 10. Sometimes they made a math saying 10 less 1, 9. And they say there are 9 ballots when actually there are 10 ballots. And at the end of the day, you need to count how many ballots were left over, and the same type of mistakes occur. So when you fill out those tally sheets, you make some of those mistakes in counting the ballots, for example. Or sometimes the ballots deposited in the box do not correspond with the numbers of voters that you have in the list of voters. There are differences of one or two, and that is a common mistake in Mexican elections, as in any other election in the world. However, these mistakes are randomly distributed, and therefore did not constitute and will never constitute a proof of fraud, and do not have any impact on particular candidates, since that errors are randomly distributed. Let me show this more clearly. This is the tally sheet. It's a complex tally sheet. It is done so because the law establishes those restrictions. Here you have what I call the reference field, all this section. And here, this is the most important section, which is the number of votes per candidate. So, this first section, you have the candidates and the number of votes received by each candidate. This is done at the end of election day. This is scrutinized by all representatives of political parties. Each party has a representative per polling station, and by poll workers. So about 10 or 12 people watch closely how many votes are received by each candidate. In general, what you have here are few mistakes during election day. The electoral court recounts many tally sheets. Sometimes there were mistakes, but in general, I would say that this votes field section had few mistakes, very few mistakes, and when that were discovered, you never discovered any pattern in favor or against a political candidate. This is very important. You can have in one tally sheet a candidate that was favored by a mistake, and you have another tally sheet in which the other candidate was favored by a mistake. So in general, you don't have any evidence of a pattern to benefit or to have a negative impact on any candidate. Then you have the other section, which is this, in which you have to write the number of ballots received at the beginning of the day, the number of ballots that were annulled, the number of ballots that were left over at the end of the day, and in general, in these four fields, in these four areas, you have some mistakes in which one or two votes do not correspond with reality. Again, in 2000, 51% of tally sheets had some sort of mistake here. In this election, we have less errors, but this became a very hot issue and an argument to say that there was a fraud in the making on the part of IFE. The other is that the IFE didn't allow a full vote recount. In this, I can only say that this was not our responsibility, that was IFE's, that was the tribunal responsibility. We had done 3 vote counts on election day. The citizens counted the votes and did mistakes. They did mistakes. And this is one of the lessons learned. How do we reduce those mistakes in a system in which you randomly select Mexican citizens, many of them with a 5-year formal education level, and this is an important lesson to learn. Second, the tally sheet district by district count make the following Wednesday with the representatives of political parties. And finally, the Federal Electoral Court, which ordered a 9% recount of the precincts, confirming IFE's results. Now, my argument so far has been to say that technically speaking and logistically speaking, IFE did and performed well with the same standards of the past, and I would say in many aspects with better indicators of its performance, simply because it has more experience than 3 years ago and 6 years ago. But that is not to say that this was the perfect election, because it wasn't. There are some controversies around the election. And I would say that in Mexico, fraud came to represent a very expansionary concept. It was not only referring to election day, but the context surrounding the election. And I would say that if I am going to argue in favor of the numbers and the results and the logistics of election day, the cleanness and impartiality with which IFE and the citizens run the election, I also must say that there is controversy around the conditions previous to election day, and I'm not going to say if this is good or bad, but just put the issues on the table. And I would say that the most important lesson, second to the margin does matter, first lesson. Margin does matter, in this case it does matter. And second, all rules for new problems create conflict all the time. If the law does not represent reality, of if the law do not respond to the new necessities of political conflict in reality, you have a gap, and that gap explains part of the conflict. So to say it differently, our electoral code was approved in 1996 basically to deal with issues of transparency, legality, and impartiality on election day. And it has done a pretty well job in making elections transparent, despite the fact that many people still consider that there was fraud on election day, which is unfounded. Evidence have shown that it was a clean election, but that law approved in 1996 didn't deal with new problems that have arisen today. And let me talk about those problems. What are those problems? Well, political advertising and activism prior to legal campaign period, what is called pre-campaigns. Indeed, in 1996, when our electoral code was approved by the Mexican Congress, you didn't have that problem. Indeed, in that decade, the problem was that you didn't have open competition within political parties. The discussion, as you may remember, was that within the PRI, which was the hegemonic party at the time, people were asking, inviting, stimulating more open participation and competition. So in that time, the concept of pre-campaigns was not an issue of discussion, and therefore is not in the law. There is not a single mention of the worth of the concept pre-campaigns, not a single. Today, in many state laws, many state electoral codes, you have the inclusion of that concept, but at the federal level, you don't have that concept included, and therefore, IFE didn't have much to do. And if you remember, since 3 years ago, accusations, dissatisfaction, and frustration on the part of public opinion began to be arising regarding pre-campaigns, because there was much money being spent. Nobody could audit that spending. We didn't know what that money was coming from, and therefore this is a new problem, and the Mexican electoral code do not deal with pre-campaigns. The second issue of this campaign was negative advertising. Here in the US, you are very accustomed to negative campaigning, but this is a new issue in Mexican politics. In the US, negative advertising is part of a democratic process to make people know information about who is running for office. In Mexico, this is a new issue. Many consider this has negative effects on the type and the quality of Mexican democracy. But this is the first time ever that we have this type of campaigns. The Mexican Electoral Code establishes in Article 38 that you need to avoid negative advertising, but this is the first time ever in which the electoral authority has to deal with what means negative advertising, how you prove negative advertising, What type of words or images or music does it be included for this to be negative advertising? How much time you need to require for negative advertising to be put off from TV screens? IFE, for example, do not have any authority to make to enforce that a TV station takes political negative ads out of the screen. We don't have any authority. So in this election, the IFE review sanctioned more than 29 TV ads, sanctioned political parties, and asked political parties to put those ads off the screen. However, when IFE did that, it was usually frequently 8 days after a claim had been made before IFE by a political party, usually saying that the other political party had been putting ads discrediting or with negative content. So each, for a period of about, I would say, 2 months, the executive area of IFE was basically working on analyzing the content of negative advertising, and this is one of the things that we need to think in the future. Negative advertising provides information. Negative advertising reduces the quality of democracy. Is it good? Is it bad? And if it is bad, how do you regulate that? Because the question is not that if it is bad. What are the best means to regulate that? If IFE is going to review all political ads and it will take a few days to do so, then when you say this is a political negative ad and therefore it must be taken off from screens, therefore you will have a second TV ad and a third TV ad, and it is a never-ending story, and we need to decide what type of rules do we need to have. Then we had another new problem, a new phenomenon of political advertising by business and civil society organization, that which is part of the democratic process in the US, issue advertising. In Mexico, it's a new phenomenon and was perceived by many as unfair, not only on the part of the business organizations, but I would say that on the side of unions, for example. This has been barely said, but many people in Mexico said also that if business organizations were going to be forbidden from making political advertising, so should be for the union movement in Mexico, which openly lobby as well. So again, in the Mexican law, the only thing that is said is that political parties are the only ones who can hire ads, political ads on TV and radio. That is the only thing said, but doesn't say explicitly what is the meaning of political advertising. What about if a TV ad do not have any explicit content of an electoral nature, as was the case in this election? What happens if business organizations or unions do advertising on the Mexican press? That is allowed. The Mexican law is not quite explicit at how to interpret what type of limitations or impositions. And if you detect that a business organization is doing some type of political advertising, there is no way in the Mexican law as it is today to sanction a private and business organization. So let's decide that we detect that a business organization is doing and violating the law. There is no way to sanction that organization. And I would say that one of the problems of this election was that IFE was demanded to act in many instances with no sanctions whatsoever. What type of authority can limit the behavior of political actors if there are no ways to sanction those actors in case they do not abide by the rules? That is the case of the media, that is the case of private groups, that is the case of government officials, in which you may want to restrict their behavior, but you don't have sanctions to make those that behavior effective in place. this, which is not so new problem, which is the political activism of the president, state governors, and other public servants. This is not new problem, but this is the first time this becomes so visible, this becomes so conflictive. This problem has been in the place since 1994. It's not new. But this time is the first time that this becomes one of the axes of political conflict, and it did, as it was included in the final ruling of the Electoral Tribunal, and I think we need to discuss this. The Mexican law, the only thing that says is the president, and for that matter, any government official cannot provide resources, government resources, to finance political activity of his or her party. It also says that any public government officials cannot press subordinates to vote in favor or against a political party. But aside from that, in general, it doesn't say anything about prohibiting the president from expressing publicly his or her political desires. It doesn't forbid a state governor to go and participate in a political rally. So many of the things that the tribunal said that it had, that the president had put the election at risk by openly supporting the candidate of his party, is not to say that the president behaved illegally, because in general, the president, by expressing his ideas, was not violating the law, but was putting the election at risk. So here again you have a difference of a legal interpretation of the election and another interpretation by the Electoral Tribunal, which is to say, what the tribunal is saying is that even if this is not an illegal behavior, the expression of ideas and support on the side of the president, this is undesirable in terms of fairness of an election. So what is our lesson for the future is that the tribunal is basically saying, make explicit in law what the president can and cannot do during an election, because if you don't have that behavior explicit and the limitations explicit in law, you will have always controversies around what is legal and illegal. And if you want to close the gap, how you make an election fair? Well, you need to limit what the president can and cannot do. And I think this is one of the first lessons and most important lessons about this election. You can have a behavior which is legal in accordance to the electoral code, but from the perception of the electoral tribunal, those legal activities may jeopardize the fairness of an election. And this is very important. For IFE, we had to follow the law. For the tribunal, that law must be changed. Another new, well, this is not a new problem, it happened in 2000, is campaign spending limits. IFE is beginning to review campaign expenditures. And early in 2007, we will have final results of those audits. But given the levels of advertising, IFE will be very strict in reviewing these expenditures, because one of the most frustrating things on the part of society is to see that campaigns spend a lot of money and that sometimes people, candidates and parties, are not accountable on their finances, and therefore again, as IFE did in 2000, IFE will be very strict and will sanction in the case it finds irregularities during campaigns. Let me say that given the lack of clear rules on within the electoral code, IFE did some actions which need to be said. First, we make obligatory for political parties to disclose pre-campaign expenditures, despite the fact that the Mexican law doesn't says that. We ask political parties to disclose expenditures of pre-campaigns. As I said, we banned 29 negative ads, banning after 5 days in place. For many, is totally irrelevant because the ads had already been in place, been aired. But as an authority, you cannot ban by not providing a process of investigation. We did, and we issued banning neutrality rules, and the most important of them, as we banned government ads for days prior to election day. And in opinion of the Electoral Tribunal, these neutrality rules issued by IFE help to limit the negative effects made by the president expressing his ideas. The tribunal indeed said, well, IFE helped to limit, to contain the negative effects of the president who put the election at risk. And we also enforced early disclosure of expenditures in media advertising as well. With this, let me conclude by saying this. Electoral organization and management, I think, is in good health. It's my opinion, it's the opinion of experts, it's the opinion of international observers. Despite accusations and allegations of electoral fraud, I think electoral organization work well. But we need to distinguish that from the arbitration and the political refereeing. What is the role of the president? What is the role of other public servants? What is the role of business organization? What is the role of other political actors? So that the election is not only clean, but perceived as fair. And I think that distinction between cleanness and fairness is probably what has created all this troublesome discussion. Cleanness is guaranteed by the Mexican system. Cleanness is guaranteed by IFE. Cleanness is guaranteed by our Mexican law. Cleanness has been recognized by international observation. Fairness is a controversial issue. The Mexican law has a lot of gaps vis-a-vis reality, and therefore, in the opinion of many, we need to do a lot of changes to increase that fairness. And that discussion of the fairness of the competition, I think, what is at stake in the political debate for future years. Thank you very much.
Well, Luis Carlos, that was, I think, a very thorough presentation. And I think I have a few questions, but we'll open it up for a Q&A, and we'll get into a discussion as we get into the Q&A period in the back. And if you can please identify yourself.
My name is Nelson Olavarrieta. Nelson. Nelson Olavarrieta from the Mexican Embassy. I want to know if the tribunal made some observations on their final decision, observations to the IFE, and in that case, what is your position about those observations?
The what? In its final ruling, the tribunal says that the IFE did an impartial and transparent job, then citizens acting as polling workers did an impartial job, and that those are the observations made to IFE. It did an impartial, clean, legal, and transparent job in organizing the election. There is no observation on the contrary. There is no suggestion that IFE lacked action or did fell short of doing something. Nothing of that sort.
Before I go to the next question, if I can remind people to turn off their cells, that would be great. Joe, you had a question.
My name is Joe Dukert. I'm an independent energy analyst. I wonder if you could expand upon your remarks about the vote differentiation north-south. You said, I think, that there was not a north-south split, but if you look at the shading of the states, similar to the red-blue presentations in U.S. elections, it seemed very clear that there were regional differences in the vote between Calderon and López Obrador.
What I am saying is that, I am not, it's not my job to comment on this, but if you go within regions and within precincts, and you analyze those results, it is not that at the north, as many people suggest, the lead of Calderon vis-a-vis López Obrador was 3-1. No, it was very close races. So in general, in the north, in most precincts, Calderon won, but by very small margins, well, by margins of 17 votes, while in non-urban areas, López Obrador won by margins of 10 votes. So yes, in the north, one candidate won in general, and in the south, the other. But the differences are small. What I am saying that both candidates were competitive within regions, within areas, within urban areas, within cities, and within the countryside. It is not that in one region you have 3-1 margins and the other the opposite. You don't have that. I would suggest to go into detail. There are many texts, many papers being published in many aspects when they make that analysis. If you make a winner-take-all system, yes, you have the north blue and the south yellow, but if you within those regions, you will analyze that both candidates were very competitive within each of them.
Joe, let me just elaborate. If you graph, and we've done this here, we haven't circulated it, but we've graphed the electoral results, and in fact, it is pretty remarkable. The margin, for the most part, between Calderon and López Obrador is relatively small in most of the states. There are some states where the gap is slightly bigger, but they're relatively close. One of the things that struck me about the data that Luis Carlos presented was how well the left did in urban centers. Yes. And I'll tell you, I mean, if anything, electoral patterns in Mexico are changing. What, you know, traditionally we talked about how the PRI was very strong in rural areas and how the PAN was very strong in urban areas. I think the results in this election may actually mean that that the patterns are the mold, or that the patterns or the trends are changing in Mexico. And the left, to be honest with you, and I've had conversations with them, it's a shame that they didn't celebrate how well they did electorally, because if you look at the numbers, it's pretty surprising. And Luis Carlos had some of that data up on his PowerPoint. Let's go to the back, the gentleman with the glasses in the back.
Blair King from USAID. Couple of questions. First of all, on the playing field slide that you had and the campaign spending and the media monitoring, first of all, I think very impressive that you're putting all the resources into, especially the media monitoring aspect. I'm wondering, you had directed us to your website, and I'm wondering if these very broad numbers that you had given us are broken down both, as you mentioned, by prime time versus not, and by how close to election date, because obviously an ad or news coverage closer to election day is going to have much greater value to a candidate or a party than one that's, you know, weeks or months beforehand. If that was not done this time, then that would be a suggestion I'd make. Seems to me, as you're doing this media monitoring, it'd be very easy just to check a box as to whether it's prime time or not and what the date of the ad or news coverage was, and also be able to break down that and see if there was any bias, or not necessarily intended bias, but waiting for one party or candidate or another. Also, on this particular issue, I was struck by the fact that PAN had both spent the least and had the least TV ads and news coverage, and yet still won. And there, my question is, you also talked a little bit later about the role of the president and governors and their political statements, the methodology of this. Did this count statements either covered in the news by the president or other PAN officials, government officials, or that sort of thing as being campaign related, even if they technically were not? And so, therefore, PAN didn't actually need to spend as much because it also had the indirect benefits of incumbency. And finally, my third question is, I actually cover Asia, so I'm not familiar with the specifics of the presidential electoral system in Mexico, but obviously it does allow for more than two candidates, and I'm wondering if this looks very similar to the Philippines in Asia, which has caused all sorts of problems. Is there any discussion in Mexico of changing the electoral system, say two rounds or what have you, to force there to be only two tickets or candidates in the final round? This doesn't necessarily directly address issues of margin. Of course, you can still have very close margins with just two candidates. But the other thing that struck me about your margin slide is not just that the margin has been shrinking since 94, but also that the percentage for the winning candidate has shrunk considerably. Are there questions now in Mexico of, you know, minority presidents and the you know, possibly decreasing legitimacy of the presidency if they're now winning with only a little more than a third of the vote as opposed to 50%?
The first question is that the coverage of this media monitoring goes from January 19 to June 28, when was the last day to make a campaign in Mexico according to law. I would invite you to go into detail. I would then like to go and remind, because the numbers are very precise. It's a very long study analyzing a number of spots being transmitted. You can go into detail city by city in Mexico, time by time. You can see how many seconds was each ad transmitted. At this moment, IFE is beginning to know how much money was paid for each political ad, because what we monitor is the transmission, not the cost. And now that Paris have finally submitted the final reports of campaign spending, we will know that. Second, the numbers spent by political parties, which I showed, is what they reported. So now we need to know if actual spending corresponds to those reports. So PAN said in that report to have spent less than the other two candidates, the other two parties. Well, IFE is in the work and in the job of analyzing that information. And very important, this is the first time we didn't have that in 2000. Our information suggests that about 70% of money spent on campaigns goes to TV and radio, to TV basically. And for the first time, we have more than 2 million hours recorded of TV advertising. So each political party has submitted information about of expenditures on TV, and we will have the ability to go ad by ad to check if that ad was reported, how much money was paid, each one. What, more than 2 million hours recorded on TV advertising, and I think that will make this auditing of campaign expenditures the best ever for IFE, because for the first time we have the information available from an independent way that will be contrasted with what parties has reported to us. And finally, yes, well, the president, the discourses of the president and state governors, which had some sort of relation to campaigns, were not part of IFE investigations. Finally, there is a discussion, ongoing discussion of electoral reform, how to increase the majorities of a winning president to have wider majorities in Congress. Has been a discussion for many years, which include the second ballot, the ballotage, and the like. And not only that, even the if you can change the regime to a parliamentary like one, there is a discussion on way in that regard.
Let me go over here. I'll get to all of you.
Hi, I'm Daniel Vasquez from the Inter-American Development Bank. And there have been some allegations of the inappropriate use of the Federal Registry of Voters by some parties during the election. In fact, at some point there was during one of these newscasts that they were showing that you could actually access the registry through the internet and look at very particular information related to voters. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, first, the electoral roll is one of the main assets of confidence in the Mexican system. 95% of Mexican citizens are registered before IFE. I would say that worldwide is one of the best electoral rolls recognized by the United Nations. Second, on election day, there was basically no complaint about the list of voters, the use of your voter ID. Basically, this was a very clean aspect of the Mexican election. Before election day, yes, there were some allegations that inappropriate use on the case of the PAN. We are investigating that. The accusation was that the PAN was using the electoral roll to make campaigning matters, which is prohibited by law. And there were some accusations that you had the ability to have access through internet, which is completely wrong. Information of my voter ID card was displayed on TV, and we have discovered that it was indeed a person who worked at IFE, within IFE, who provided that information to the media. So it was not true that. It continues to be a very solid instrument, and as I said, after those allegations and politically biased accusations previous election day, on election day, this has not been an issue of debate, has not been used as part of the allegations of fraud, and I would say that we are investigating that aspect as of today.
Philip.
Philip Hughes from the White House Writers Group. Senor Ugalde, looking ahead to possible reforms for the future, one of the canonical problems of election law infraction is that the investigation, the resolution, sanctions, etc., generally take place long after Election Day. In other words, after the damage is done, and the whatever the remedy is, it doesn't remedy whatever disadvantage there was to the party who was disadvantaged by the infraction. Mexico is kind of a laboratory of how to build new institutions. Have you thought about that aspect, how more timely redress could be built into a process of reporting infractions, investigating, and ensuring redress even before Election Day?
Absolutely. First idea is that, globally speaking, the lesson of the election is that you need to close the gap between reality and the rules of the game. If you do not close that gap, you will always have controversies and accusations that the process is unfair. So we need to close. How do you close? You need to have a political discussion of what type of democracy do you want. Do we want a liberal model as the US one, for example, in which you privilege freedom of expression? Or do we want a regulated or restrictive model? We need to answer that question first. Once we have answered that, you need to accommodate the rules of the game to the reality you want to achieve in the future. What you mentioned is one of the aspects of that reform. Some types of misconducts are penalized long after the election has concluded, and in the federal level, you can have a president being seated in office, as did President Fox, and months after discovered that his campaign received illegal funds, for example. And he who pays is the party, not the president. So in that case, many people have suggested that you had to have penal sanctions against the sitting president or the man or the woman in charge of party finances, which doesn't happen in Mexico as well. My opinion, structurally speaking, is that rather than going into how to increase sanctions, you need to have preventive measures. Rather to increase oversight capacities of IFE, which you need to increase. You need to prevent campaigns from being as costly as they are today. So rather than thinking how to capture the bad guys, you need to prevent them from behaving in that way. What you need to do, in my opinion, first you need to make pre-campaigns transparent, to oblige all those people that want to pre-campaign to publish what money they are using and what money, where that money is coming from. Second, you need to make political advertising on mass media more transparent, to think about what you are doing with the type of campaigns being run in Mexico. Do we want campaigns to be won on TV screens, or do we want campaigns to be won on debates among candidates? You need to answer that question as a second very important issue. Third, you need to shorten the duration of campaigns. If you have campaigns plus pre-campaigns that altogether take years in the making, of course you will have a lot of trouble. So you need to make them more transparent and to shorten the duration of them. Fourth, you need to define what the role of the incumbent president, state governors, and other government officials may be. We need to discuss what we are going to do and what type of sanctions can you apply and can you enforce in the moment. If you need to initiate an investigation, if the president said or not said that, and if that was a violation to law, then it doesn't matter. The incentives to violate the rule of the law is there. So I would say that, and finally, you need to review campaign spending and funding. Once you have shortened campaigns, once you have reviewed political advertising on mass media, which takes 70% of campaign funds, you, at the end, can review campaign spending and funding. I think these four or five aspects are the ones to, first, keep what works well, which is a lot, and second, to build new rules to deal with new problems that are not included in our old law.
Luis Carlos, I'm going to kind of follow up on a question. You mentioned, I know that in, you mentioned point number two concerning political advertising. In your presentation, you made reference to negative ads. Obviously, negative ads are not regulated in this country. I thought they had become part of regular TV programming, at least during the month of October. Are there any countries that regulate negative ads? I mean, we know it's not done here. And do you see negative ads as being an area where, you know, there could be some regulation?
I think if you do that, you don't go to the heart of the problem. I think the heart of the problem is not negative advertising as much as it is campaigns being run on TV screens. I think that is the problem. So if you have the incentives to win campaigns on TV screens, then the incentives to do it by negative campaigning exist. So if you change the incentives and spending as much on TV becomes less and less important because you may have restrictions, for example, then you will solve the other problem. So the problem is not negative advertising. The problem is the incentives to win elections on TV screens and the fact that all parties, all candidates are doing that more and more. And when you have campaigns being won on TV screens, you have a second problem. The quality of your democracy decreases by definition, and decreases by definition because public discourse on TV ads of 20 seconds is by definition superficial, trivial, and by definition incentives the type of attacks and negative advertising which we have become accustomed in Mexico in this election. So you need to change those rules. What other countries do is, for example, that they establish and set some limitations on the time and amount of time for TV ads. Other countries simply say that the only type of public exposure on TV screens can be on debates, for example. One discussion on this election was whether we should make presidential debates mandatory. If you had presidential debate is mandatory in Mexican law, then you had other type of incentives. One of the things IFE did well, I think, in this election was to organize two national presidential debates. And despite the fact that the format may have been rigid in the opinion of many, well, it was an opportunity for people to hear and to see candidates together. I think that type of incentive, rather than making IFE the evaluator of TV ads, is a better response to a structural problem, which is, as I said, that TV screens are becoming the forum for political debate in Mexico. And when you have TV as a forum for making politics, negative advertising is a byproduct. So what is the problem? The forum, not the tactic.
In the back.
Foresee any bill to be submitted soon to end all the new problems that have not been covered by the current
code? Over the past 10 years, more than 60 bills have been submitted to Congress. For more than 5 years, many people in Mexico have remind Congress that the Mexican law requires to be adapted to the new realities. I would say that one of the best opportunities to this close race is to show that these situations, difficult and controversial situations, must be seen as an opportunity for change. So I would say that the Mexican electoral systems will be strengthened after this experience, because despite allegations of fraud, despite protest, despite conflict, I would say that the whole electoral process was conducted in accordance to law. Despite all accusations and conflict, each phase of the law, each phase of the electoral process was respected from July the 2nd to September the 5th. So there was political rallies, political opinions, political conflict, but the Mexican electoral law was respected. So that is one, this is good news for Mexico, that the rule of law prevailed at the end. Now, we need also to take into account political conflict and political demands and political allegations, because I think those allegations, political allegations, has to be included as a way to take opportunity of this conflict. I think that those people that protested, including Andrés Manuel López Obrador, have made some important contributions for future elections in Mexico. What type of democracy do we want? How do we improve the quality of our electoral competition? It is not only about transparent election days. It is also about the fairness of the whole process, and I think this is an opportunity, and this is the only way to convert the conflict into progress for consolidating our democracy in the future.
Luis Carlos, let me follow up with that question. I know that the previous general counsel, before they stepped down, prepared a document that outlined the electoral reforms that they felt were needed. Obviously, there's a new general counsel. In your presentation, you laid out some of the reforms that you think would benefit Mexican democracy. I know that the Mexican Congress, started and just finalized the composition of their committees not too long ago. Will you be preparing a document to formally submit to Congress, or have you been asked to prepare a document that lays out some of the recommendations that you see that are necessary based on the experience of 2006?
We are in the process of a global assessment of IFE's performance during the electoral process, which includes the training of poll workers, the electoral roll, how we install polling stations throughout the country, the design of ballot papers, which is very important, the type of mistakes being made during election day. We are in the making of that assessment, that evaluation. When we conclude that at the beginning of early next year, we will have a set the diagnosis, and therefore the solutions to make it better, which is the logistical aspects of the election, which, as I said, it is very important to distinguish between the logistics and the organization of the election, which in my opinion in general works well, but you can improve some steps, some phases, some logistics, and then you need to analyze the context and the conditions to regulate political campaigns. In that regard, if at the time when the discussion begins in Congress, of course, is ready to make proposals, to give its saying, and basically, from an assessment of what happened, to provide technical assistance and opinions with regards to what needs to be done in Mexican electoral reform.
Octavio, I know you've been waiting patiently.
German, Octavio José Mier, Executive Director of the Congressional Hispanic Leadership Institute, Chile. One area in your presentation that did not provide much comment was the vote of Mexicans abroad. And we saw that the potential electoral voting pool that we have abroad is about 4 million people, is my understanding. And the end result was there was only about 30,000 plus that votes were actually counted and factored in. What challenges did you obviously there's a tremendous logistical challenge in that occurred in promoting for the first time the vote abroad, but what less important lessons learned do you feel can be taken from this?
We are concluding an assessment of that as well. First, let me tell you that many expectations were rising, not by IFE, by people, suggesting that if millions of Mexicans were living in the U.S., therefore, millions of them were going to vote in case they were allowed to do so. That was not said by IFE. Our experience is that this is the first time it happens. Second, the Mexican system, the Mexican electoral system has a lot of safeguards and locks to prevent fraud. I would say that for those that suggest that on election day there was irregularities and fraud, it is impossible to imagine a system with more safeguards and locks than Mexico's. So if you were to put more locks in place, it would be impossible. You would basically need to install video cameras in each polling station if you want to improve. But it is very safe. It is bulletproofed. And therefore, Mexican lawmakers decided to put a lot of locks for Mexicans abroad. And those locks and those requisites that you established for Mexicans abroad to register before IFE to be able to vote require a lot of steps to be taken, a lot of requisites to be fulfilled by Mexicans. And we are analyzing what is the factor that explains the turnout. It was about 50,000 applications. Is that enough? Is that small? Is that less than expected? Is that good? Is this good for the first experience? I would like to give you an impression on that because on the one hand, the figure is controversial as to whether it is worth the price paid. On the other hand, there is no claim about the transparency of that process. No party has claimed that this application didn't get into time or the vote was mistakenly counted. It was very transparent and very well done, despite the figure. So we are in the process of assessing that. And of course, in a democracy, the more voters you have, the better. So in the future, I think the challenge is to keep the same locks in place as we have today and increase the number given the size of the Mexican population abroad.
Barbara
Dewey Whitman, Whitforce Consulting. Follow up on Mexicans voting from abroad. As somebody who's been very active in our own organizations dealing with U.S. citizens voting from abroad, I'm interested first in something about the logistics. Are these physical ballots mailed to state and local authorities? Are they people voting in consulates and embassies? How is it done? That's part A. And part B, the only great margin of difference between the parties that showed up in the categories that you flashed on the screen was that Mexicans abroad voted more heavily for the PAN than anybody else did. And it seems that because if there were only 30,000 of them, they obviously were not that half percent all by themselves. But has there been any backlash in the fact that one party seemed to have a whopping majority of the ballots coming from abroad?
The first is that the voting from abroad is by mail. So you apply months before election day, months before, you receive, you send an application with your address and a copy of your voter ID card, and then we send you back in your home here in the U.S. or where, or in the 71 countries where we receive applications. We send you the ballot paper with an envelope, prepaid envelope, and then you put your ballot paper and send it back to Mexico, and we keep it and we count it on election day. Second, there has been no claim about where the votes of the from abroad went to PAN, as in contrast to the expectations that it could. Many people thought it was going to benefit other parties. No comment, no analysis, however, as why this was so. And I think this is something left to researchers and analysts to see what these numbers mean, who voted, who applied for. It's important to analyze that, to see if those that applied correspond to the median Mexican living abroad.
Philip, you have a follow-up on this, don't you?
Yes, I do, actually. More a follow-up on the whole line of questioning that began with my first question, or the whole line of discussion. You've described, and it's understandable, in a system that's based on a sort of Napoleonic code law, an approach to election law that involves essentially progressive regulation of things, regulation of what the president can do, what governors could do, and so forth, and being more and more precise about that as the way to, you know, sort of achieve perfection for Mexican legislation or Mexican elections. What about a completely philosophically alternative approach, which would be more in the direction of doing everything you can to defend the integrity of the electoral kernel, so to speak, of electoral processes, registration, actual voting, transparency of counting, and so forth. And then, apart from some, you know, very basic and minimal regulations to avoid the most obvious abuses, like prohibiting government officials from requiring their subordinates to vote a particular way, leave it wide open. Anything goes. And let it be authentically competitive and, if you would, democratic. Some people will have certain natural advantages, unions. Other people will compensate for those natural advantages with natural advantages of their own, money. Why not a much more open approach rather than a restrictive one, since there's never been a human law made, as far as I'm aware, that hasn't spawned a very ingenious effort to get around it?
This is the question for the future. I tried to say that in my presentation, but this is a question for the future. Keep it, the integrity of the system as it works well today. Make it some fine-tuning changes which are required, but it basically works and works well and has been recognized worldwide. If you go into our webpage, you will read most of the comments from international observers and you will see that it is recognized. It was a clean election. Now, what type of regulation do you need for the other things prior to election day? The political answer on the part of many in Mexico today would be, let's make it more restrictive so that everybody shut up and only candidates can openly discuss ideas. Restrictive and regulation in place. The other one is the one you mentioned. Minimum regulation and leave it open. The liberal model versus the regulatory or the restrictive model. What type of future do we want for our democracy? The answer to this question depends on the quality of democracy we want. How do we enhance political debate? How do we inform the public best? By restricting the president or by leaving it open as far as the president and state governors abide by minimum rules? I am not going to give the answer to these questions, and I hope I haven't provided what is best for Mexico. What I am trying to say, and I think this is very important, that we need to begin from the answering to this question. If nobody answers and makes the question, do we want open, do we want liberalism, or do we want regulation? Do we want to favor freedom of expression, or do we want to favor equal conditions or fairness, to say so? What principle do we want to maximize? Answering that makes the rest of the reform easier to attain, because at this moment I think that there are many problems being together and we are unable to distinguish one thing from the other. This is basic for Mexico's future. And I think at the moment there is no clear answer to that. Most countries in the world are following your proposal route.
Arturo Clares, a private consultant. Excuse me for speaking in my own language, because my mind works better. Primero felicitar a Luis Carlos por la presentación, me parece muy completa, muy centrada. Y hay uno de los problemas que, en mi opinión, se deberían considerar para futuro. Y este es el papel de los medios, y en particular me voy a referir a la televisión. Y esto es particularmente importante porque en México solo tenemos un monopolio, un dipolio, pero es un solo monopolio. Es decir, no es como en Estados Unidos, en que tenemos muchas fuentes y hay grupos que trabajan con el Partido Republicano. Entonces, esto de alguna manera da un balance en cuanto a las opiniones. En México no. En México hay una sola empresa que es la que marca siempre la línea, y particularmente esa empresa además se lleva el 70% de los recursos que el pueblo de México destina a la elección. Y no me refiero solamente a los anuncios de los partidos, sino a toda la programación. Hay programas de noticias, sí, pero las noticias se manejan siempre en favor de uno u otro, o no u otro grupo. Hay programas de comedias, de chistes, que son las particularmente que más ve la gente, y es ahí justamente donde se da todo este desbalance en cuanto a la forma en que se maneja todo esto. Entonces, muy particularmente muy importante, ¿cuál va a ser el papel de los medios, en particular de la televisión, y cómo se va a financiar eso?
Contestaré en español también. Esta es la pregunta de contenido. La otra pregunta era la pregunta teórica del tipo de democracia electoral que queremos. Esta es la principal pregunta de specifics para reformar. Primero quisiera dar algunos datos y después decir lo importante. Esta es la ocasión en donde la cobertura noticiosa es la más balanceada en la historia de las elecciones en México. Yo los invito a que vayan a la página del IFE y vean que en términos de segundos, en términos de tratamiento editorial, en términos de opiniones favorables, negativas y neutras, los tres principales candidatos a la presidencia recibieron un trato semejante. De hecho, el que más cobertura recibió, se ve en los números, fue el candidato López Obrador, pero en general es en un rango semejante. Las televisoras y la radio a nivel agregado nacional fueron sumamente cuidadosas en proveer de acceso y de un tratamiento semejante. Primer asunto que decir. Segundo asunto que decir es que el anuncio pagado por los partidos políticos en televisión nacional y regional fue semejante. Es decir, los tres principales candidatos tuvieron acceso y recursos para anunciarse en cantidades semejantes, y ese es un dato muy importante porque en términos de medios de comunicación es la elección más equitativa en la historia de México, por cobertura noticiosa y por anuncios pagados. Quiere decir que en el aspecto fundamental para llegar al electorado, esta es la elección más equitativa que ha habido en los últimos años. Ahora bien, el aspecto negativo es que, como dije anteriormente, el focalizar las estrategias de campañas a través de la televisión tiene el efecto inevitable de reducir la calidad del debate político, de trivializar la política y de estimular las campañas negativas, la difamación. Y por eso me parece que para el futuro, si nosotros queremos evitar el deterioro de la calidad del debate en México, lo que tenemos que cambiar son los incentivos que hoy son para hacer el 70% de los gastos en televisión. Y no es por un asunto de si las televisoras se llevan o no los ingresos. Esa no es mi preocupación. Mi preocupación es la calidad del debate público en México. Y si mantenemos a las pantallas de televisión como el foro para debatir las ideas políticas, vamos a contribuir a que la política se siga deteriorando. El problema de las campañas negativas no es censurar las campañas negativas, sino es limitar los incentivos para que las campañas se ganen en televisión. Por eso me parece que la pregunta es cómo lo hacemos. Debates obligatorios, restricciones al número de anuncios que pueden hacer, tiempos gratuitos en televisión, obligación para que lo único que se pueda transmitir por parte de partidos sean programas de 5 minutos, como en otros países, con lo cual inevitablemente evitas que haya difamación. La difamación surge porque tienes 20 segundos para exponer una idea. En 20 segundos o expones una idea o generas una percepción o una emoción. Cuando tienes 5 minutos obligatorios para exponer una idea, no puedes difamar 5 minutos, tienes que exponer una plataforma. Ese es el asunto de fondo. Y por lo tanto, si hay un asunto fundamental de alguna futura reforma electoral en México, el primer punto en la agenda es cómo revisar el tipo de relación entre partidos y medios a fin de mejorar la calidad del debate político. Ese es el asunto fundamental en cuestiones específicas para el futuro de México.
Bueno, creo que se nos está ya concluyendo el tiempo. Luis Carlos, yo te tenía una pregunta última y no sé si la puedas contestar o no.
¿Por qué voté?
No. Pero estaba haciendo referencia a cómo avejentaste en los últimos meses. Creo que avejentaste más la noche del 2 de julio. Pero déjame hacerte una pregunta. Esa noche, ¿tuviste tú alguna comunicación con los candidatos antes de salir a la cadena nacional para anunciar? ¿Hubo alguna comunicación o a través de los representantes de los partidos notificando la decisión que se había tomado? Y otra parte, ¿has tenido alguna comunicación con los candidatos desde ese día? En cuanto al proceso.
Esta es la primera ocasión que voy a comentar esto. Nunca lo he dicho, pero y es importante que quede registrado. La noche del 2 de julio, el día 2 de julio y desde el 2 de julio no he tenido ninguna comunicación verbal, personal, física ni escrita con ningún candidato a la presidencia de la República. El 2 de julio, el comité técnico del conteo rápido, que estaba sesionando en un búnker donde no había manera de comunicarse por protección del ejercicio del conteo rápido, yo recibí en la sala de transmisión de televisión del IFE un sobre cerrado por parte de los 5 miembros donde se me informaba alrededor de las 10:40 de la noche, de una noche lluviosa, la conclusión de la recomendación del comité técnico, en donde se establecía que no era posible dar a conocer el resultado del ganador debido a el empate técnico. En ese momento, en el teleprompter, donde ya había 4 modelos de discurso previamente elaborados, se tomó el modelo B, que ya estaba escrito, y se añadió la conclusión del comité, que leí 10 minutos después. Quiero decir también que se ha argumentado que el hecho de que el presidente Fox haya salido inmediatamente después de mí significa que yo le avisé. Antes de las 11 de la noche y en los días previos al 2 de julio yo no tuve ninguna comunicación con el presidente de la República. Supongo, habrá que preguntárselo a él, que también tenía grabados los mensajes posibles, y muchos han interpretado el hecho de que el presidente haya salido inmediatamente después de mí como una sugerencia de que había comunicación de lo que había sucedido. Nadie en el país antes de las 11 de la noche supo el resultado del conteo rápido, más que los 5 miembros del comité técnico, sus asistentes que estaban en un búnker, y yo a las 10:45 de la noche. No hubo otro mexicano en este país que supiera el resultado del conteo rápido, y yo me enteré a las 10:45 de la noche, y fuera de estos mexicanos que acabo de escribir, no había otra persona que supiera del resultado hasta las 11 de la noche. De hecho, nosotros estábamos obligados a dar a conocer el resultado del conteo rápido a los partidos políticos, y para evitar cualquier filtración, en el momento en que yo empezaba a aparecer en televisión, hubo los miembros del comité técnico le estaban entregando de manera simultánea los sobres a los miembros del Consejo General del IFE, los partidos políticos, para que se supiera. De tal forma que yo diría que el conteo rápido fue totalmente confidencial hasta las 11 de la noche, cumplió los estándares técnicos más elevados, ha sido demostrado con los números que se predijo desde esa noche lo que iba a pasar, y vamos a ver días y semanas después. Y cuarto, creo que el elemento fundamental es que un empate en política siempre genera finales anticlimáticos y en ocasiones frustración por parte de los participantes, por parte de la población, y algo que sucedió la noche del 2 de julio. Comportamientos adelantados de los candidatos que salen a manifestar sus posiciones y con eso inician un fenómeno de descalificaciones, que es lo que vimos en las semanas subsecuentes al 2 de julio.
Luis Carlos, no sabes cómo te agradezco. I think it was a very thorough presentation. I think your comments at the end, I think, were quite candid, and I appreciate. I didn't know whether to ask you that question or not in public, but I thought I would anyway. I was down there, as you well know, that evening, and it was a very, very interesting evening for me as well as a political analyst. And please join me in thanking Luis Carlos for today's presentation. Algo ahorita.